Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're blessed to have with us David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And Dr. Ernest L. Martin was considered by many as a genius concerning the Bible, archaeology, all of those things pertaining to Scripture. And frequently, privately, accolades were heaped on Dr. Ernest L. Martin for his insight into the Scriptures. But publicly, the same people kept silent. So, anyway, I feel it's a real blessing to have David Seeloff with us. And tonight we're going to talk about Bible secrets. Many things that people really don't know about, and many things that as they sit in the pew, they are never taught. They never hear of it. And these are things we're going to talk about, and this will be a multi-part series, I'm sure, because there are a lot of them. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne.
How are you tonight?
Oh, terrific.
Good.
Terrific.
Good. Well, let's get started on our project here.
Okay. The book that this is being taken from is called 101 Bible Secrets That Christians Do Not Know. And the latest edition was written by Dr. Martin in 1998. He had written an earlier edition in 1993. But it's broken down into chapters, and, you know, there's actually 12 chapters. The first one is about Hollywood theology.
Yeah, boy. Yeah.
On how Hollywood gets it wrong. And then the second chapter is questions about God. And then chapter 3 is about questions about the Bible. Chapter 4 is questions about chronology. Chapter 5 is let us now go to hell, questions about hell and punishment.
Right.
Chapter 6 is questions about prophecy. Chapter 7 is questions about sexual themes. Chapter 8 is questions about Christian doctrines. And chapter 9 is questions about rituals and salvation. Chapter 10 is titled Questions About History. Chapter 11 is questions, or the Garden of Eden and Noah's Flood. And chapter 12 is political Bible translations. Then there's several appendices that are longer. Some of these Bible secrets are short, very short, and some are long. And they're kind of like Reader's Digest type articles. Actually, they'd be ideal for Reader's Digest. And that they, you know, they just look at the Bible differently and plainly let the text convey what it actually says rather than what people and theologians think it says, which is, of course, very radical in itself.
And this book is available on your website, right?
Right, right. It's available at www.askelm.com, and it's online, available completely, as well as available for purchase. And
so people can go there if they do not have money, they can go there and read this book online, right?
Right, right. Or
that's great.
Print it off if they want. They can do whatever they wish. And you know, it's available to the world through this. And you know, Dr. Martin, a few years ago, as he notes in his introduction, he went into a bookstore of a major Southern California theological seminary it's probably the same one I attended. And he asked the clerk for a book that talked about the world's oldest profession. And the clerk didn't answer that they didn't carry such books, that their specialty was in theology. And Dr. Martin informed the clerk that that was the very subject in which he was interested, because theology is, in fact, the world's oldest profession.
Yeah.
And it's easily proved. When Adam and Eve were, in there, they were talking about God. When Satan tempted them by saying, "Yea, as God said." So that was the first professional question in all history, was by the serpent, and it concerned God. Satan, the serpent. The serpent then proceeded to answer his own question that he himself had asked, and the dialogue evolved, and that was a theological dialogue. And since that time, the prime questions that people talk about all through history have been ones involving theology.
Yeah.
Birth, life, death, marriage, continuation of the race, what happens after death. This is all about theology, and it all concerns God. And people are curious about these questions. And once Dr. Martin explained that, the clerk at the bookstore smilingly said they have over 10,000 books here on that, on the oldest profession, and he'd gladly sell Dr. Martin any of them. And so the clerk was quite amused at this. What we're going to talk about then in this book is the matters concerning the world's oldest profession, the 101 Bible secrets that Christians do not know. And we're going to talk about little-known but important Bible teachings that God and his written word have that are often overlooked and misunderstood, misapplied, misused, or deliberately abused by people who have occupied themselves with trying to understand the Bible. And the truth is, however, if people would genuinely ask questions about God and his ways, not in a way that the serpent proposed, but, in questioning God's authority and questioning God, but ask questions and then patiently wait to read or hear the answers as revealed in the Bible, and then believe what they read, most questions about God would have been thoroughly answered and understood, centuries ago.
That's right.
So the problem is with us. The purpose of God actually is to, the Bible is a revelation of God. It's an unveiling. It's a removing of the cover of the information that we really want. It's God's communication to us, and it's God speaking to us. We pray to God, he answers through his written word. That's the system as it currently is right now. Later on, it will be in a more face-to-face, on a more direct manner. But at present, this is how God's operating, and this is the system that he has set up to communicate with us, and that we can then communicate with him by asking questions of his words back and forth. And if we don't avail ourselves of that means of operation, of communicating with God, then the fault is with us.
That's right.
We can be judged on that. And yes, it's up to God to open our minds. But we should be asking for that too, that he open our minds more and more each time. So this little book that Dr. Martin did was actually a small favor that he did to all of his readers over the years and to himself, and that we should slow down and read what the Bible says on these 101 subjects. And they may seem trivial at first, but if we can get rid of our preconceived ideas, we'll be amazed at what the Bible actually does in fact say.
Yes.
And it'll begin to make sense to us, for the first time in many cases. So, you know, let's take a look at some of these. And first of all, he has some instructions. And the first instruction, there's three basic principles that he tries to adhere to throughout this little book. One is that the soul, we will not go outside the Bible to define the meaning of biblical terms. And this is important because, let me get back to where I was here. And this is important because the Bible is its own best interpreter.
That's right.
It gives plain and simple answers to the questions of life. And it gives it in plain and simple language, in Hebrew, a little bit in Aramaic, and in Greek. And this was the Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek of the common person on the street. It wasn't high theological language, although you have that on occasion in portions of Isaiah and in the book of, or in the in Hebrews in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we will not introduce any Gentile philosophical or religious principles or alien ideas into the Bible to explain biblical doctrines. That's called eisegesis. In other words, we'll let the Bible speak for itself rather than inputting ideas and then trying to mold the texts around what our preconceived ideas are.
Well, you know, that's real important, David, because in many, many instances, between religions, plural,
right,
and Hollywood, pretty much they've trashed the Bible.
Yeah,
you know?
And they've gotten it completely wrong.
Yeah.
Even, you know, even Mel Gibson's movie, he used a Catholic mystical source, the book of a Catholic mystic, to fill in the details where Scripture was supposedly silent, but in fact it was not. If he would have gone farther and looked into the Old Testament, in Isaiah and other passages, he actually would not have been able to portray what Christ looked like at the end of the crucifixion. It would have been a lot worse than what was depicted there,
yes,
actually.
Yes.
And, you know, he chose to do what he did for whatever reason, and my point is that it was incomplete, and this is common that what preachers and priests have done with disastrous results is they've inserted non-biblical concepts and ideas into the biblical record, and they don't fit. And the third principle is that we will let plain biblical statements on the condition of the dead guide us and not allegorical or poetical renderings that the dead are alive. The Bible teaches the resurrection from the dead at the second advent of Christ, not a continuation of life at death. And those who have died are completely dead and awaiting the resurrection from the dead at Christ's second advent. The dead know nothing about what is going on in the earth, on earth, or under the earth, or in heaven today, and only Christ has been resurrected from the dead to be at the right hand of the Father. All others are dead, and completely and thoroughly unconscious and are absolutely unaware of anything in the world of the living. This is plainly stated in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 5, and in several other places also. The importance of this, of knowing this, central biblical truth will be evident throughout several doctrinal sections of this book. So let's start with chapter 1, the first secret of the 101 Bible secrets. And the first one is that the Ten Commandments were actually pocket-sized. They weren't these huge, massive stone blocks that are portrayed. When Cecil B. DeMille produced the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, who played Moses, they brought down from the mountain two huge stones that surely must have weighed, you know, a good 50 or 100 pounds each. And even in older movie versions of the Ten Commandments, those are also portrayed as huge. And actually, Dr. Martin says that he saw those stones years ago when he toured one of the movie studios, and they were actually made of foam rubber because they would have been too heavy otherwise.
Yeah.
But is this an accurate depiction of the stones on which the Ten Commandments were written? That's the question. Well, Dr. Martin answers that the truth is, the Bible shows that Moses was very able to carry both stones in one hand. And this is in Exodus chapter 32, verse 15. He didn't carry them on one arm. He carried both stones in one hand. The stones were actually quite small, about pocket size in dimension, you know, like the size of a telephone today, or, you know, a handset, or the size of a calculator, actually. And they were small, slate-like stones that could be carried in the palm of one hand. Though to keep them from rubbing together, he often carried them in both hands, one in each hand. This is stated in Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 15. Now, another point that is usually not understood is that each stone had the Ten Commandments written on both of its sides, not just on one side alone. This, again, is in Exodus 32:15. And something else, many scholars now believe that the two stones were actually duplicates of one another. The second stone was an exact copy of the first. In other words, Moses was given one stone with the full Ten Commandments written on it, front and back, and he was given a second stone, which was an exact copy of the first. And the reason for this is these duplicate stones were designed by God to be a double witness to the Israelites to meet the requirement of there being two witnesses that had to be in evidence in life and death matters. And this is in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 6 and 7. For legal purposes, it looks like God gave Israel two identical sets of the Ten Commandments that as a dual testimony to their serious nature and how serious they were. And this shows alone how far off Hollywood can be when it comes to depicting biblical events. You know, the giving of the Ten Commandments was a big deal, so people just assume that it required huge stones. But, we shouldn't really blame Hollywood, because the movie industry has only been showing what Christian painters and sculptors, under the influence of theologians, priests, and church leaders, have erroneously concocted as biblical teachings over the centuries. Now, so that's secret number one, is the stones of the tablets were actually quite small. Bible secret number two is that Hollywood doesn't know anything about stirrups. Stirrups on horses. And actually, both Hollywood films and television specials have been guilty of another falsehood regarding the biblical period that is so evident to anyone who has studied the history of Western civilization, and that is that they often show riders on horses as having saddles and stirrups.
Right.
Some of the great film masterpieces that Hollywood has produced about the life of Jesus or the period when the apostles lived often show Roman soldiers riding horses with saddles on them, and that's fine. But the saddles are often shown with stirrups to hold the feet of the riders. And after all, our modern saddles have to have stirrups because Hollywood directors don't want their people, the actors to fall off their horses.
Yeah.
But Hollywood is actually quite wrong. Stirrups on saddles were not invented until the 5th century after Christ. And there's some evidence that suggests that their invention was actually 2 centuries later. So, you know, if you see a Bible movie where the horses have saddles with stirrups, that didn't exist till quite a bit later.
Right.
So, and actually, actually some of the later movies in recent times, like Alexander the Great and recent Bible movies, they're pretty good about that. I've noticed that they've switched, and they show them not having stirrups anymore. Some of the I'm watching for that.
In biblical times, they didn't have fancy bridles for horses either.
No, they didn't. And actually, the riders were skilled enough, usually, if they owned and had a horse, they were skilled enough to control the horses, actually, with their legs.
Yes, that's true.
Which was allowed them to keep their... And, of course, the American Indians did that.
Yeah.
And that's why they were so effective and could use both hands for spears and weapons and bows and arrows and that sort of thing. So that was Bible secret number two, no stirrups on the horses. Bible secret number three is there is still creation of animals going on after the time of Noah. Now, Hollywood has shown Noah gathering together to enter the ark many of our types of animals that we have in the modern world. And actually, this is quite wrong, as Dr. Martin understood. Though the Bible says that Noah got pairs, or in some cases, seven pairs of all animals then existing that had been created in the period when Adam and Eve were created, there is a second account of creation written by King David that most people don't even know anything about. And this shows a further creation after the flood of Noah that brought into existence many types of animals, insects, and other living creatures that we know today that did not exist in the time of Noah. So the answer, Dr. Martin, that was the introduction, but the answer is that the ark was large, but it was not large enough to hold specimens of all the vast numbers of animal types that we see on Earth today. There is a second account in Psalms, going from containing Psalm 103, 104, 105, to the end of Psalm 106. And whenever you consider the creation accounts of in the New Testament, of John chapter 1, and in the book of Exodus, you should also consider this entire collection of Psalm 103 to Psalm 106.
That would have been written by King David?
Correct. Under the inspiration of God.
Mm-hmm.
And though these four Psalms cover a single biblical account, and they're to be read as a single unit. And after a general introduction from Psalm 103, verse 1 to verse 18, David, in verses 19 to 22 of Psalm 103, describes God's use of the angelic host in the first creation mentioned in the book of Genesis. Psalm 104 then starts with the creation of the heavens with the aid of the angels, verses 1 through 4 of Psalm 104. Then the earth is created with its oceans, and finally, its land masses, and this is in verses 5 through 9 of Psalm 104. Then the fresh water, grasses, and other vegetation were created, along with the birds and the cattle, and also mankind. And this is in verses 10 through 19 of Psalm 104. The sun and the moon are made to provide a calendar for man, and the world is made harmonious for all life forms. And this is in verses 19 through 28 of Psalm 104. But then a destruction takes place when God turns his face away from the living, and they all die and return to dust. This is in verse 29. And then God sends his spirit of life, and the result is the renewal of, quote, the face of the earth in verse 30. This is a time when things were created, and then great seismic disturbances took place. In this creating of animals after the flood of Noah, God no doubt designed many of our modern forms of animals and insects that are made for the renewed type of earth that came into existence after the time of Noah. And David continued his account of world history in Psalm 105 by mentioning Abraham, Jacob, and then continuing on through Psalm 106 to the end, bringing things up to his time and up to the time of David himself. David brought into review all the main historical events associated with Israel up to the time that Israel became a united nation just before the time of David. The information in these four Psalms represent the second account of God's creation of things on earth. And what it shows is that God can create animals or insects anytime he pleases. And after the flood of Noah, he devised many of the life forms that we're familiar with today. And Hollywood, though, knows nothing of this second account of creation in these four Psalms after the flood of Noah. And most preachers, priests, and theologians don't know anything about it either. Therefore, they don't bother with them. So it's not a rival account of creation. It's an expansion on what God made in Genesis, or describes in Genesis.
Give that chapter and the verses again.
Okay, that would be chapter, Psalm 103, 104, 105, and Psalm 106. And if you read it carefully and break it open and study what it's actually saying, you'll see that this is another description of creation. So it's really quite an interesting study, and you can do this on your own. And, you know, it doesn't take Bible experts in order to do this. So, you know, have fun with that. So that was Bible secret number three. Bible secret number four is that the Red Sea was crossed by the Israelites. They crossed on a bridge of ice. And, you know, we see the Hollywood depiction of this biblical event, the crossing of the Red Sea, is also completely filled with error.
Yes, it sure is.
When the house of Israel crossed the Red Sea dry shod, it says with dry feet, most people imagine that the sea opened up and that a stretch of the sea bottom, now made dry by the land, by the wind, was made available for them to escape the Egyptians. It's also assumed that there were walls of water being held back on each side of the canyon-like walkway so that the bottom of the seabed of the Red Sea became dry. And that when Pharaoh and his host, his army, the next morning entered this canyon-like roadway, then the walls of water collapsed on both sides, and the Egyptians were drowned. And this is the classic interpretation of the event. But is it true? Well, in no way does this describe the real biblical event. And people have written us and said, well, what Dr. Martin has written couldn't be true, until they studied this in detail, even to the Hebrew, if you want, and went into it. And the people were quite surprised.
Yeah,
they're quite amazed. And they've come back to us and said, you know, what he's written is actually, that's what the text says. I just never saw that before. But what actually took place was something very different than the common view of what happened at the crossing of the Red Sea. When Moses composed his song of victory after Pharaoh and the Egyptians were destroyed by the waters of the Red Sea, Moses said, quote, they sank to the bottom as a stone. This is in Exodus chapter 15, verse 5. And again, in verse 10, it says, they sank as lead in the mighty waters. These two verses seem to show that Pharaoh's army was on top of the waters, and then they sank down.
Right.
Well, how could they sink as a stone and sink as lead if they were already on the bottom of the seabed? And besides that, Moses said that the Egyptians were cast into the sea, in verse 4, as if they were on some kind of bridge, and they were hurled overboard into the waters. Now, a bridge. You know, don't throw the book away and just say that this is some kooky opinion, someone who must be as batty as a barn owl, Dr. Martin writes. If you slow down and read the text for what it actually says, you'll be amazed how clear the whole thing is becomes. And that, you know, you may have to read this two or three times to get a proper reshifting, a paradigm shift, as some people say, to rethink this matter. And, you know, the Israelites went across the sea on a bridge, a natural bridge that God created out of the water, composed of ocean water, at the northern end of the Gulf of Suez. The water was turned into something. The Israelites actually crossed the Red Sea on a type of bridge which was floating on the surface of the Red Sea. And it was a bridge constructed from the ocean water. And there are several clues that Moses gives which allow us to understand the matter. First of all, Moses said something that happened to the waters when God began to, quote, blow a wind with his nostrils. This is in verse 8. In other words, with a blast of thy nostrils, the waters were gathered together, in verse 8.
Yeah, that is in Exodus?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Exodus chapter 15, verse 8. Okay. Fill in the Song of Moses.
Okay.
And that is, the wind caused the water to begin to pile up as they became to compress. Now look at the last part of verse 8. And as a result of the gathering together or the piling up of the waters, the text goes on to relate that the floods stood upright like a heap, as if it was a heap of stones, not two heaps of water on each side, but that the water itself stood like a heap. Now Psalm 33, chapter 33, verses 6 and 8, uses similar language. It says that God, with his breath, the breath of his mouth, gathers the ocean waters in a heap, and he places those heaped up waters in places for storage. Well, how could that be? You know, how can God place waters, which look like a heap of stones, into some storehouses of the deep? He not only can, but he does. Now read the next verse of Moses' song, verse 7. Moses said, quote, the floods stood upright like an heap, and the depths were congealed in the hearts of the sea. And now we can know what happened to the waters in that part of the Red Sea. The waters were congealed. And what does water do when it congeals? Well, every school child knows this. Water is congealed when it's frozen.
Right.
And this is just like the psalmist in Psalm 33, verses 6 and 7, who said that God had placed heaps of frozen water in vast storehouses. The huge ice cap regions of the Arctic are certainly in storage within the deep. And, you know, any large-scale mountains, a set of mountains in ancient times had glaciers. And they understood what glaciers were. And they were water that is stored in the deep. So Moses then said that the blast of God's nostrils caused the water in that part of the Red Sea, when they were congealed, to stand upright like a single heap of stone. Not two heaps, or heaps plural, but a single heap of stone. And similar language is found in Job chapter 37 and verse 10, where it says, by the breath of God, frost is given, and the breath of water is straightened. In other words, water becomes hard when ice is formed, and people can walk on it if the ice is thick enough. And frozen water, that is any slab of ice, also stands up like a heap when it floats on the surface of the water. When a slab of ice is in water, about 10% of it will stick up above the surface. as we know from the study of icebergs. It will, as Moses said, stand up, quote unquote, because ice is lighter in weight than water. Indeed, in the Arctic today, huge trucks can cross over lakes in the wintertime on ice bridges that cover the lakes. The Russians during World War II supplied Leningrad over the frozen lakes, building highways in the ice over the frozen ocean water and the lakes that were in, to the east of Leningrad during World War II.
But you know, we've got that saying, you know, it's only the tip of the iceberg.
Right, right.
You know, very little is above the, you know, the water line or whatever, and most of it is below. But then, yeah. You know, David, a lot of people would say, well, you know, that area of the world is always hot, and it never snows. There's no ice there.
Oh, it snows in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen pictures, and it snows in unusual places, and if God blows his breath, it will be frozen, if he so chooses. I mean, I used to walk from across the lake to class in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, they would do ice fishing in Wisconsin. The entire Lake Michigan would freeze over in not in recent years. I don't think it has done so in the last 20 years, but the entire Lake Michigan would freeze over, and theoretically, it's, of course, very dangerous to do so. You could walk from Milwaukee to Michigan, you know, tens of miles across. You know, nobody has ever done it that I know of because of the danger, but, you know, what we're talking about is the entire population of Israel during the Exodus walked across that area of water. Only a waterway, the whole of the Red Sea did not freeze, just a section of it, a roadway, so to speak, that stood up as a heap by being miraculously frozen. It stood up about 10% of its height above the surface of the water, like icebergs do in the ocean, and there remained open water on both sides of the ice bridge. So that when that melted, or sank, Pharaoh and his army were thrown into the water, and they sank to the bottom like stones and like lead. So, you know, it's still a miracle, believe me.
Yeah.
There's no doubt of that. But that's the, you know, secret number four. Now, secret number five, the last one in this this section, is about the long-haired Jesus. The long-haired Jesus is a pagan god, and one of the most grievous errors that Hollywood has made in their depiction of Jesus while he was teaching here on Earth is that Jesus did not have long hair. And there's no evidence, any pictorial evidence, before the 4th century that suggests that he even had a beard.
Well, they depict him as Zeus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zeus or Serapis.
Yes.
And being somewhat feminine in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Although some movies do, you know, show him as being quite masculine.
You know, there's a very old artifact called the Chalice of Antioch.
Hmm.
And on that chalice is a depiction of Jesus Christ as a child and as a mature man. And as a mature man, he did not have long hair.
Well, frankly, nobody did
at
that time, not the Romans or the Jews.
Yeah.
The Apostle Paul said that the Apostle Paul utterly condemned long hair on a male human being. This is in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 4. I'm sorry, chapter 11, verse 14. 1 Corinthians 11, 14. Because males were created to be in the image of God, and Christ did not have long hair, and nor does he now have long hair. And there's absolute proof that Jewish men, along with the Greeks and Romans of the time, customarily wore their hair short. In the Bible, long hair to the shoulders like that was normally associated with women, and in Revelation 9:8, it's confined to a description of evil spirits. Nowhere else are, you know, spirits or men described as having long hair. But evil spirits in Revelation 9:8 are so described. The so-called Jesus that we have in churches and books today is a 4th century concoction that is an image of Zeus, the chief of the pagan gods, especially in his Serapis or Egyptian form. And if the apostles would come back to life today and go to Christian churches today, they would be aghast at seeing a pagan god, as far as they would be concerned, being displayed and being called of all things Jesus.
That's right.
This is where the biggest problem emerges from having pictures and icons of Jesus, because that's not what Jesus looked like. And first of all, we shouldn't have pictures of Jesus. And second of all, they shouldn't look like a person with long hair. Even if it were the true likeness of Jesus being displayed, the scriptures forbid such a thing to be done. And this is in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 4. When Aaron, the brother of Moses, made the likeness of a calf and called it Yahweh, we find that the Lord became very angry over that matter and killed a great number of people for idolatry.
Yes.
Because they made the likeness of a calf, which actually symbolized an angelic creature, a cherub, who as being the one who led the Israelites out of Egypt. And that cherub was actually there and present. And even Moses allowed cherubim to be placed in the Holy of Holies. But this cherubic personage was not the God of Israel, who symbolically sat on the throne of the sapphire above the cherubim in the Holy of Holies. In other words, Aaron displayed the wrong deity. Now let's look at this for a moment. Suppose you went into a church and hung a picture of John Wayne next to that of Jesus and told the people that this picture of John Wayne was what Jesus looked like, and that it should be substituted for the other long-haired Jesus that Christians have accepted since the 4th century. If you did this, most people would laugh or scold you to shame for such a false depiction. Well, that's not what Jesus looks like. And, you know, most people would be right. Jesus doesn't look like John Wayne.
Right.
But that's what we've been doing since the 4th century. We've replaced the real Jesus with Zeus in the form of the Egyptian Serapis, with his long hair and beard that we now call Jesus. This developed, actually, once again, because of dreams and visions, when people had dreams and visions of Jesus who would come to them and appear as a being with long hair. But, you know, are you going to believe a dream or a vision, or are you going to believe the Apostle Paul, who also had a dream or had a vision of Christ? And Paul said that, you know, Christ does not have long hair. It's a shame for a man to have long hair. He's nowhere described in Ezekiel or in Revelation as having long hair. His hair is white as snow, but it doesn't say anything about long hair in Revelation, early chapters of Revelation, where Christ is sitting there in his exalted state. When he appeared to the apostles, he looked the same to them, except he had, wounds in his hands and in his feet. But they recognized him as the same Jesus resurrected. You know, Hollywood follows what the general public want and what the general public expect. It's like calling a picture of John Wayne and saying that that's Jesus. It's pure nonsense. And Aaron did the same thing when Moses was on Mount Sinai. He made a god. He made God to look like something else, and then told Israel to worship this false depiction. And again, let me state clearly that, and scholars know this, the image of the long-haired, bearded Jesus is not the Jesus of the Bible. It's none other than Zeus or Serapis, the chief pagan god.
There sure are a lot of churches around that have this long-haired Jesus.
Right.
In statue and in paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can hardly avoid it.
Yeah.
And actually, it's the Christians in Jerusalem, when the Apostle John says, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, "Flee from idolatry." Well, any depiction of God or Christ is idolatry.
That's
but because
right.
It's such a part of our culture that we just ignore what God wants and what God says, and we, you know, just do it. Well, it makes us feel good, and I'm not praying to the picture. I'm not praying to the statue of, Jesus or Mary or the statue of this apostle or this saint or that saint. I'm praying to John Paul II prayed to Mary, and he was proud of it. You can go on the Vatican website and read the accounts of his prayer to Mary.
He also kissed the Quran.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He kissed the statue of Mary.
Oh, dear.
Several times. Well, that's adoration. That's worship. And that's incorrect and not biblical. Flee from idolatry. Keep yourselves from idols. So those are the first five of the 101 Bible secrets. And, this might be a good place to break, yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well, I know that there's a lot of people out there, David, that really appreciate the information that you bring. And they're going to appreciate this too, because more and more there are people, and they're not a lot of them, but there
right.
are people that are really intense in their search for the truth. This is so good. Okay, we will continue, and this is part one. So, God bless you all for listening. You can email David at david@askelm.com. Go to the website. You will find the book that David is drawing this material from, 101 Bible Secrets. You will find this at the askelm.com website. You can download it, print it out, or you can purchase the book, whatever you like. The information is free. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff signing off from this segment of 101 Bible Secrets. We will be back. And God bless all of you out there listening. Good night.